This is Car Expert.
It would be safe to say the most Australian Corvette ever, which is not really saying a lot, is it? But nevertheless, we do like to kind of insert ourselves in everything that we can.
It's great in, you know, most respects, but it doesn't feel like a BMW to me.
I reckon this one will be sending some shivers up the spines of every ute company. This new Ranger looks like something else.
Hello, my name's Mandy Turner. G'day, Mike Costello.
Hello, Mandy Turner.
And hello, James Wong.
Hello, Mandy Turner and Mike Costello.
This could go on all day. Hey, Jero, you went did a bit of off-roading the other day. How'd that go?
It was a lot of fun. So I'm reviewing the Isuzu MU-X LSU at the moment. It's the kind of vehicle which I feel a lot of people will use for different things, whether it's towing or off-roading. And obviously the whole pitch about cars like that is that you can go anywhere. So I really felt that it would be a disservice to the readers and also to myself if I didn't actually get it a little bit muddy. So I headed down to the Werribee 4x4 park that we use for filming and all sorts of things. And Paul was shooting a video down there. So I was like, I'll just use one of the trails behind you and I won't get in your shot, I promise. And so I just went down some of the tracks. I'm quite a novice at off-roading. I haven't done a lot of it. I haven't really participated in any like off-road mega tests that the team has done in the past. So it was a really good experience for me just to sort of understand how it all works. And it also was a test of the vehicle's capability, because if someone like a dummy like me can do it, surely anyone can. So a lot of the readers will probably recognize the offset mogul track that Paul uses in most of our videos, as well as the logs on the hill climb. So they're a good test for wheel articulation, ground clearance, 4x4 systems, all that kind of stuff. So I can report so far that the MUX didn't miss a beat. And even though I was, almost wetting myself because my mirror was nearly touching the ground, it was going so sideways at one point.
Oh, my God.
It was a great experience. I'm somebody that gets quite queasy when, like, my center of gravity gets moved around. So if I'm about to go down a very steep fall or I'm going to go very sideways, it sort of upsets my stomach a little bit. So I had Scott Colley sort of guiding me through it, because he's done it before, and he will probably comment that I was just like squealing a little bit because I was a bit nervous.
Yeah, the single worst thing about off-roading, but also the most exhilarating thing about off-roading, and I love off-roading, I'm quite a keen off-roader, is what you feel inside the interior is always much more substantial and marked than what it looks like on the outside, because you do an offset mogul or you get a 40% side lean or you take on a 50% or 45% uphill gradient and it feels like you're about to tip backwards or tip over. And then you see a video of yourself and you go, it doesn't look anywhere near as dangerous. It felt way worse inside. And the great thing about off-roading is you can't appreciate what an adrenaline rush it is by watching it. You have to experience it, especially in, you know, a really capable car that can take you on some places. And there are a few more fun things to do. I actually think off-roading is a bit more entertaining than even track driving if you find a good trail.
Mm.
Absolutely. Did you get it filthy dirty, Joe? Because I always feel like utes look extra sexy when they have mud all over them.
Yeah. Well, the MUX is so tall and so high off the ground that I only really got the wheels and tires dirty, though some of the puddles were quite deep. There's a little bit of splatter on the wheel arches, but that's about it. It actually did quite a good job. I probably got it dirtier just driving on the dirt roads around that area rather than actually at the 4x4 park. So far, I've really enjoyed that car. I can see why they're selling so many of them, because it's just so capable and actually very comfy. I'm not a big fan of ute-based wagons because normally they're quite compromised in terms of refinement or quality or whatever it is. And I think that the new MUX is really it really does square up with the Ford the Everest quite well, because that's one that we normally comment, you know, it has a very SUV like ride and quite comfortable and quiet to drive as a daily. So I've really enjoyed that car so far, so keen to get share some of those photos and write that review.
Good stuff. Looking forward to it. Well, from utes to vans, Moco, this is a very interesting story. It seems like we've had a bumpy year for van sales.
Yeah, look, so I'm sick to death of, leaning too much on on, you know, obviously to a degree we find news that is happening front and center, but I think it's equally important sometimes to stop and reflect and actually analyze the market and try and find, I guess, unique insights that you're not seeing elsewhere. And one thing that I picked up recently was the absolute explosion of mid-sized vans. Now, it's pretty obvious why that's happening. You see that, you know, Australia Post and every logistics company under the sun has got months-long delays and they're taking on thousands of new staff because of the e-commerce boom that's happened during the pandemic. And clearly, correlation and causation aren't always linked, but in this instance, they absolutely are. So this year, vans, particularly mid-sized vans, which is the real guts of the segment, Toyota Hiace, Hyundai iLoad, Ford Transit Custom, these real big sellers, 19,543 of those types of vans have sold this year over the first 9 months, which is the highest ever. The previous highest was in 2017, and that was just over 16,000. And generally, it oscillates around 13,000, 14,000. So this year, we've seen a huge spike. The Toyota Hiace, despite being one of the most expensive vans, is absolutely dominant. More than a third of the van total in this segment belongs to the Hiace. But we've also seen fantastic growth from the Transit Custom. The Chinese LDV G10 is up 130% this year. The Renault Traffic is well up. The new Volkswagen Transporter is doing really well, as is the Mitsubishi Express, despite its less than sensational safety rating, according to ANCAP. So I think it's fascinating to have a look at this to see that not only are people buying used vans, but they're actually buying new vans for this purpose. And in a time with stock shortages and in a time where, you know, we're struggling to get vehicles on the ground, there's at least one segment that's actually booming.
Do you also think it could help that vans are becoming a lot more comfortable these days?
There's been a couple of joking commenters saying because of the average price of real estate, maybe people are buying vans to live in them, which probably has some legs. No, I think, look, vans are clearly, you know, tradies and van drivers and couriers would get absolutely duped with the safety equipment. It was as if they were second-class citizens. They wouldn't get all the good safety equipment, but that's not the case anymore. Most vans now come with side airbags and five-star ratings and autonomous braking and all those features that you want, the Hiace being, you know, the best example. And clearly those factors play a big role. People are more comfortable potentially buying vans. I think unlike utes, though, vans are very much a fit-for-purpose vehicle. So I don't, you know, a lot of people drive Rangers and Hiluxes as their second cars, maybe as the backup family SUV or whatever. It's hard to imagine too many people using a Hiace for much else other than loading stuff into it. But I definitely think that, you know, is an absolutely brilliant thing for van buyers regardless.
Yeah. Which van do you think is the best on the market at the moment?
Well, I think the Staria Load, the new Hyundai Staria Load, I just love the way that thing looks. It looks like a spaceship. But my actual favourite van is probably the Ford Transit Custom. I think it's a sensational thing. Solid steel bulkhead comes as standard, unlike on most. All the active safety stuff, really gutsy diesel, good pricing, good servicing. Everybody buys the Hiace, and I totally understand why, but I reckon I'd be ponying up for the Ford if it were me.
Looks a little better too.
Yeah.
A little more sporty. I think the Hiace looks a little bit like a brick when you're driving one from behind. All right, we will get into this week's news now. Moko, it's over to you. It is official now that VinFast is now selling Lang Lang.
Yes, indeed. The Lang Lang Proving Ground, the famous General Motors Holden Lang Lang Proving Ground, where some of the greatest Australian vehicles of all time were exhaustively developed. Some of the magic that General Motors Holden's engineers were able to kind of conjure at the Lang Lang facility over the years. And I was lucky enough to head down there a few times when it was still operational to get a look behind the scenes, and an amazing facility. Now, VinFast, the Vietnamese automaker, bought it around 12 months ago with some big plans to, you know, really use Australia as, I guess, an engineering and development hub, VinFast being owned by the richest guy in Vietnam. But that company has pivoted since then because of COVID and other factors. Now it's focusing on the US and Europe, doesn't really see Australia in its plans anymore, and has decided to pull the pin and sell the Proving Ground off. So it is now officially listed. There's a whole bunch of complexity that comes into this because there are environmental groups that are concerned around, you know, the impact that it could have potentially on the natural habitat and ecosystem out in that part of southeast Victoria. You know, it's quite unclear whether there are any international OEMs that would be interested in buying a world-class, recently updated proving ground in Australia. Not because the facility isn't extraordinarily good. I mean, it's continually been invested in right until it was sold. But more that Australia isn't exactly a hotbed of automotive development anymore. So in my heart of hearts, I can't help but think this is going to be sort of flattened and turned into, like, you know, housing estates and things like that, which I certainly hope isn't what is in the plan. And at this stage, it's quite hard to know. But no matter what happens, it is a sad thing to know that we thought this wonderful asset in regional Victoria might have a saviour. There might be a company coming in that would, you know, utilise it as Holden did. And, well, that's now back in flux again. So, yeah, for any automotive, you know, enthusiast in Australia, I think it's a fairly, you know, interesting one that we really want to watch.
Can you have a word to Alborz for us? See if we can buy it. That'd be great. Thanks.
Can you imagine the content we could do? Car expert proving ground out at Lang Lang.
Oh, man.
You know he's good for it.
Yeah, you just set up your offices there 24/7.
Oh, the content we could do, Mandy. The reviews, the comparos. Oh, my God, it'd be amazing. Maybe. Yeah. Maybe we can crowdfund. Alborz is too stingy to pull his wallet out, but maybe we can crowdfund with our listeners and our readers.
I think that's a great idea. Hey, JWO, more powerful Chevrolet Corvette is coming to Australia. This thing is a weapon.
Yes, it's very, very exciting stuff. So Chevrolet has revealed the Corvette Z06, which they call a 2023 model. Americans have this thing where model years are sometimes 1, 2, 3 years into the future. So it's basically the fastest Corvette, and it's actually going to be made in factory right-hand drive, like the normal ones. I'll use the term normal very loosely. So the main part of it, like previous Z06s, is that it's got a stupidly powerful engine, and this one makes 500 kilowatts and 623 newton meters, and it's a hand-built 5.5 liter naturally aspirated V8, which has the code name LT6. Chevrolet actually says that it is the highest horsepower naturally aspirated V8 to hit the market in any production car ever, and that's the quote. So it's big numbers, and the engine itself is actually a version of the motor that they use in some of the race cars, which is pretty cool. So think of it as sort of like the Corvette version of like a 911 GT3. It's like their road going race car sort of thing. But if you look at the photos that we've got on the website, there's a very bright orange and very racy looking coupe, which also has Carbon Revolution wheels that are an Australian company, which is really cool, that are made out of carbon fiber. And also this, I actually really like the look of the Z06 convertible because it's very restrained and classy, and it's quite interesting how there's two very distinct personalities of the two different cars. So it drives into the rear axle via an 8-speed dual clutch automatic, like the standard Stingray, but it's got a shorter final drive ratio at 5.56. There doesn't seem to be any performance figures as yet, but you can imagine that it's going to be very, very fast. The standard car can already hit 100 from a standstill in under 3 seconds. So I don't know how much faster you can really get than that.
We all know that a naturally aspirated V8 isn't really about straight line speed either. It's all about the exhaust sound. I mean, 650 newton meters is kind of poxy by today's standards, hilariously enough. You mentioned before, Wongy, the Carbon Revolution wheels, which are made in Geelong, the Victorian regional city, which I think is an extraordinarily cool story, an Australian company providing the wheels for a top-of-the-range Corvette. But the Aussie connection doesn't stop there, because the global head of design for General Motors was the former head of Holden Design, Mike Simcoe, which means that the Corvette was also designed, obviously not penned by Mike, but he oversees the department and the company and the team that designed the vehicle. So it's been led by an Australian from the get-go, and it also uses Australian components, which I think makes this, it would be safe to say, the most Australian Corvette ever, which is not really saying a lot, is it? But nevertheless, we do like to kind of insert ourselves in everything that we can.
Yeah.
We'll take it. We'll take anything.
Absolutely.
Now, Marco, this was a really interesting report. You dived deep into the 2022 Range Rover reveal. This is a gorgeous-looking luxury SUV. Can you give us a little bit more detail into this, please?
Oh, I could give you 4 hours of detail if you had long enough and you had a mind. I mean, a new Range Rover, it's just the fifth generation since 1970. So, you know, a new one doesn't come along all that often. And we've seen the Range Rover family expand with the Velar and the Evoque and all these things. But at the end of the day, the Range Rover, the eponymous Range Rover, is ultimately what it's all about. And this one comes with a lot of new things. The headline acts are the fact that it now has a seven-seat option in the long-wheelbase version. And not only that, but the seventh seats, or the six and seventh seats, are big enough for 6 feet tall adults to fit comfortably. There's a plug-in hybrid with about 80 Ks of pure electric range. And there'll also be a full electric one coming in 2024. So they're the big picture stories. But if we look at the design, it's quite evolutionary in some ways. You know, the clamshell bonnet, the short front overhang, the really bluff sides. But some of the fine detailing on this car is superb. If you really hone in on, say, the grille fascia, or you hone in on the graphic along the side, just at the front of the side front doors, the way that they sit so flush, the way that they're beautifully kind of finished, the way that the double glazed glass is almost completely flush with the pillars, the extraordinary kind of attention to detail is what really stood out to me. The LED headlights, each unit has 1.2 million individually controllable digital micro mirrors. That's per headlight unit. So you can kind of see this, the sheerly insane level of detail that goes into this vehicle. And when we look inside, look, it's pretty much all touchscreens now. That's, some people like that, some people don't. They're going for the sort of clean finish, the 14-inch digital instruments with the 13-inch center touchscreen that's nicely curved. Company does say 90% of functions are only two taps away, but, hey, we'll be the judge of that when we get to drive it. JLR wants to redefine luxury materials, or so it says. So it's working with a company called Kvadrat, which is a really well-known textile company. Near aniline leather, which is furniture grade, is obviously still available, but so too are some new man-made leathers and wool fabrics with recycled materials. So that sort of sustainability model is catching on. Back seats can obviously recline like armchairs, have got their own 11-inch touchscreens. That third row, as I mentioned before, comes to the fore. There's also a really cool evolution of the signature split tailgate. So obviously the lower part you can use as a bench, but now there's actually a piece of the load floor that flips up with cushions on it, so it turns into like a full kind of settee arrangement in the rear of the car, which couldn't be more Range Rover if it tried. In terms of technology, it's got a lot of over-the-air update capability. So there are 69 individual ECUs fitted to this car, two eSIMs, so OTA can happen without it interrupting other things that are happening at the vehicle, a 1600-watt Meridian sound system with up to a kilohertz of active noise cancellation, embedded Spotify. So this is sort of a really high-tech vehicle. We don't think about Range Rovers as being about tech. We think about them being, you know, herringbone and leather and wood, but this also has all that tech as well. There's one great feature I love for off-roading called the ClearSight Ground View. Basically, it uses cameras to show you exactly what's happening under the car, so it's as if the bonnet were transparent. And there's also LED downlighters that make a beautiful big pool or a carpet of light around the car when you're reverse parking at night. Just little touches like that. And if we talk about engines, the new 4.4-litre V8 is the hero. There are also some mildly hybridized 48-volt inline sixes, and of course that EV is coming soon. A updated 4x4 system, the same Terrain Response 2 system as you've seen in the Defender, and of course a Range Rover, what differentiates it from, you know, the Maybachs and the Bentley Bentaygas of the world is that it's actually good off-road, and this one shows absolutely no signs of not living up to that. Now, the order books open this week, actually, and deliveries for Australia start in June next year. And then the FEV and the top-of-the-range SV sporty model will come a little bit down the pipe. And then the EV one, probably in Australia, late 24, early 25. So while it might look evolutionary from the outside, everywhere you look on this vehicle, JLR has thrown not just the kitchen sink at it, but it's basically thrown every conceivable thing that it possibly could at a vehicle to make it really what it is. And it is still, to me, and not everyone would agree with this, I'm sure, but to me, it is the pinnacle of luxury 4x4s. It's the original, and even if it's not the best, it's still kind of the pinnacle anyway.
Yeah. Joe, well, you love your British cars. What do you think of this?
I really do like it. I just don't want to look at it from the back. I'm not a fan of that new rear design.
I love it.
It's, It's got like this weird like Mercedes-Benz X-Class light signature, which I'm not a huge fan of just yet. I might change my mind. I've had that a lot recently where a lot of cars look a certain way in pictures and then I don't really like. I like them much more when I see them in person. But yeah, everything about this car looks so cool. I love that they're going, you know, they're bringing out an electric version. They've got some great powertrains in there. The available features and the 7-seat option, all that kind of stuff is really cool. And like Mike said, there's been a big shift towards SUVs of late, and we've seen a lot of the high-end boutique manufacturers try to emulate Range Rover by having, you know, you think of your Bentaygas, your Maybachs, your Rolls-Royce Cullinans, but something about the Range Rover has always appealed to me, and I think maybe that's because it is the original and it sort of transcends that class. And it's sort of how, you know, the launch of a new 911, the launch of a new Golf, the launch of a new whatever is a huge deal. And I think a new Range Rover sort of fits into that. It's one of those automotive icons that it always moves the game forward and it's always setting the benchmark. And I think just that alone will bring people to the brand. And the stuff about the sustainable material stuff is really cool too, because you think of what the kind of people that would ride around in Range Rovers, the people that are very you know, environmentally minded, things like that. You'll be able to get a plug-in hybrid, an electric one. You can have a sustainable interior, so you're not using animal products. Like, it's really good that we're seeing more and more of that in the industry now. And yeah, can't wait to see one in person, because I love the current one so much that this next one, seeing all the improvements, it's obviously going to be in another league again. So exciting stuff.
Absolutely. It's got such a big presence. Now, Jamal, we've got more local details that are being revealed for the 2022 Tesla Model Y.
Yes, so there's a Tesla shipping tracker called Vita Prime that has shared some details on its Twitter account about the upcoming Tesla Model Y, which is expected to launch in Australia sometime in 2022. Some overseas markets have started seeing them, so America and Europe have started getting them on the road, but we're still waiting on final details. So we can see a little bit of what to expect now. So apparently there's going to be two battery sizes and three trim levels. So we'll have something along the lines of a standard range or standard range plus, and then a larger battery for the long range and the performance, which is pretty similar to the Model 3 lineup here, which the Model Y is effectively an SUV version of. So for the long range battery, there'll be a 505 kilometer range in long range guys and 480 kilometers in the performance, which is a little bit down on the Model 3, but still fairly competitive against some newer competitors from other brands. And the document lists power outputs of 255 kilowatts for the standard range, 378 kilowatts for the long range, and 393 kilowatts for the performance. So the other details we still don't really know yet, but the standard features in the long range and performance will include stuff like heated and power adjustable front seats, heated rear seats, a tinted glass roof, LED fog lights, and a 14 speaker sound system, which doesn't really go into that much detail. They're just some very minor highlights, but yeah, it's going to be interesting. And like the Model 3, we'll probably get them from China as well.
Model 3 has become far and away the top selling EV in the land. It's about 70% of all EVs sold at the moment are the Model 3. Tesla's too stubborn to tell us its sales figures, which is frustrating. That's for another day. But what we do know is the Model 3 is dominant. What we also know is that SUVs are the dominant body type, and this is just an SUV version of the Model 3. So I'll bet you anything that this time next year, the Model 3 has fallen way off and the Model Y is dominant. And it will be not just the top-selling EV, but it will be by far and away the dominant EV, the Model Y. Every competitor will be crapping themselves seeing this vehicle. I guarantee it.
And it seems like people are really interested in it too. A lot of our coverage on Car Expert, a lot of people comment how they're waiting for Model Y and how they're interested in Model Y because perhaps a Model 3 doesn't really suit them with the body style or whatever. So I imagine some of the delay for this car here will likely be because it's taken off in other places in the world, and they're probably anticipating a similar story here. So you'd hope that they don't run into massive stock issues like some other brands, because otherwise you'll have a lot of unhappy customers.
Indeed. And lastly, Moco, it's good to see that Ford Australia is once again leading the global development for the Ranger.
It is, yeah. So clearly, probably the most high-profile Australian automotive project left for the world is the Ranger one, the T6 platform-based Ranger and Everest program. New generation versions of both those cars are just around the corner. And Ford is now giving us the classic official spy shots. So, you know, vehicles that are disguised testing, but they're shared officially by the brand, that hilarious in-between content. But I guess the interesting thing about this is, and there's a great story on the site written by Jack Quick, our newest news journalist, and I really encourage you to go and have a read of that. But it basically goes to depth throughout just the sheer scale of international global testing that this vehicle has gone through, obviously led by the Australian R&D team based out near Geelong in Victoria's regional west. And it really gives some insights into just the torture testing. You know, so it's the equivalent of 625,000 off-road kilometres at maximum load capacity in testing, you know, muddy bush tracks through to 50-degree deserts, through to snow, you know, in right near the Arctic Circle there, computer testing, real-world testing, squeak and rattle tests, the full works. Clearly, there are always going to be people that are sceptical about a vehicle's reliability, and the only thing that can prove reliability is time. But what we do know is Ford has thrown absolutely everything at trying to make sure that this new Ranger does the task it's designed to do, especially now this one's going to be a lot more high tech. There's going to be a plug-in hybrid. The 2-litre bi-turbo is going to be standard. There'll be a ton, you know, of extra interior and active safety tech. More stuff means more things to go wrong. So obviously testing in that instance becomes all the more important. But based on everything we've seen of this new Ranger, you know, the current outgoing one is ancient and it's still the top seller. A bit like we said with the Model 3 in the last section, I reckon this one will be sending some shivers up the spines of every ute company, like Isuzu, like Mazda, that have got great pickups, but this new Ranger looks like something else.
Okay, the full news links to those stories and many more at carexpert.com.au. You were in your element last week, Joe, scooting around in a hot hatch, the all-new 2021 BMW 128 Ti. No doubt it would have been a nice comparison to your own Golf GTI. Yes. Do you think this will be a big seller for BMW?
Well, given I've actually seen quite a few on the road in the last few weeks, I reckon it seems to be finding favour with a few people. Ooh. It's quite an interesting car. So it's not many premium manufacturers double in like that lower tier performance segment. Normally we've seen with the German brands, they'll sort of go for that Golf R level of performance, which is like your A35, your M135 I, and the, what's the other one? The Audi S3. How could I forget that? So normally we've seen that. But so BMW sort of went another rung below and sort of was targeting that younger, maybe more enthusiast side of the segment, and is gunning straight for things like the Golf GTI, the Megane RS, and the Focus ST with a high-performance front-wheel drive hot hatch in the 128 Ti. So it uses a 2-litre turbocharged four-cylinder petrol engine, which is pretty similar to the one that's in the M135i, but it's been detuned and also the all-wheel drive system is not there anymore. So it has 180 kilowatts of power and 380 newton metres. It claims to hit 100 from standstill in 6.3 seconds, and it's got an 8-speed sports automatic, but a conventional automatic, not a dual clutch. So it's very similar in concept to something like a Golf GTI or a Focus ST, and it starts at $56,900. So it's not far off those cars in terms of price either, now that we're seeing a Golf GTI somewhere around $53,000 plus on road. So for a not too big step up, you can get yourself a car with a premium badge. Now, if you can get past the looks, which are a little bit polarizing.
That'll be my next question, actually.
yeah. So if anyone follows me on Instagram, you'll see that I got a really cool pic of it with like a graffiti background. Mm. And I very, very specifically photographed it from the rear, because that's the side that I think it looks good from. I think the back is nice and wide. It's chunky. It's angular. It looks sporty. Then you turn around to the front and it looks like it's, been bitten by something, or it's got a rash and it's like bloated up. I don't know. It's too disjointed. The front's really cutesy and round, and then the rear's really angular and sharp. And I just feel like whichever two teams did that design, just sort of one was in charge of the head of the B pillar and the other was in charge of the rear. So looks aside, you know, it's, I reckon if you spec it with the right color and the right wheels and whatever, it might look all right. Mm. So the main thing about this car, obviously, is driving it, and driving it, you know, with a sort of sporting bent. And given I own a Golf GTI, as you said earlier, the team thought it was probably best for me to do it because I sort of have a bit of background with that style of vehicle. And, you know, in the long story short, it is a nice car to drive. I think that objectively, performance is great. It's so torquey. The 8-speed automatic is quite smooth. It does have that sort of premium ambience to it when you're on the road, in that, like, it's there's still a bit of, like, a lot of entry-level European product has tire noise issues, I find, and I think the BMW UKL platform that the 1 Series is based on, that also underpins the likes of the Mini range as well as the X1, I've always complained that the road noise in those cars is a little bit higher than it should be. But other than that, like, the way that this car feels, it's very sporty, so it's not so much – I wouldn't call it – so much of an all-rounder, mainly because it's quite stiff. Even if in its comfort setting, it's actually very firm. So it's probably as firm as my Golf in its sport setting in comfort, wow. Which is going to be more a matter of personal taste. I know some people really like that connected, raw feel of a car with harder suspension. But just for me, you know, driving from home to the office, for example, I go on freeway into, like, quite pimpled city roads and going over tram tracks and things like that. I can't remember what it was that I was driving over, but I was in the city and I rolled over a bridge join or a you know, a tram track, and I'm pretty sure I hit the bump stop, and it's not a nice feeling when you hit that, even at 40 k's an hour. But once I got it out on some higher speed roads, it really came into its own. So on the freeway, you feel so secure. It's very, very stable. Even in adverse weather conditions, I drove it in very, very heavy rain at 100 k's an hour, and not once did I feel nervous or unsettled. It was very, very planted, very secure, and it inspired a lot of confidence. And then once you get out into some bends, like, it does have very quick and direct steering. It's got a nice little soundtrack to it. It changes direction with good, you know, finesse, and it does sort of feel like an overgrown Mini, which is a good thing and I guess a bad thing, because this is also almost like a BMW's version of the Mini JCW hatchback, because it's essentially the same drivetrain in a bigger car. So I think that for someone that may be downsizing, or maybe, I don't know, thinking that they like that sort of front-wheel drive balance, that they might see this as a really good alternative to something like a Mini JCW, because you get obviously a much bigger car with a usable back seat and a usable boot, and it's still fun to drive, and it's got obviously that very desirable BMW badge on it. But I felt that this car just had a bit of an identity crisis, because I've tested the previous generation 1 Series, and I drove a 125i in a previous job, and even though it wasn't as powerful as this one, I feel that rear drive balance and the way that that previous generation of BMWs handled, you got a little bit more weight through the steering. It felt a little bit more natural, and it felt like a true BMW, whereas this current one, it's great in, you know, most respects, but it doesn't feel like a BMW to me. And so it's sort of like my thing would always be, like, you know, you go for a 3 Series over a C Class because you want, you know, a sportier, more engaging drive, one that's, you know, it's not as simple as just driving up and down the main street. You might go on a twisty road on a road trip and really enjoy yourself. And I just didn't feel like this car just didn't give me I don't think it knows what it's trying to be. I think that's what I'm trying to get to, whereas, you know, a Mini is more fun, because it is that little bit smaller. It's got, you know, the retro-inspired looks, and I feel like the John Cooper Works models have a raucier exhaust note as well. This one felt a little bit restrained, so I was like, okay, it's not, even though it's got all the Mini running gear, it doesn't sound as fun as a Mini. It's a BMW, but it's, you know, it still sort of feels like, you know, a Focus or a Megane, where it's sort of, you know, it's nice, but that front wheel drive thing just doesn't feel very BMW. And the looks as well, you don't look at it and go like, oh yeah, that's a cool BMW. It sort of is a little bit disjointed in that regard. So in the big scheme of things, yes, it's a cool car. Yes, it's fun to drive. Yes, it's, you know, a great little performance car, and it's affordable enough, but I just don't see you know, this kind of segment, a lot of people are drawn to heritage and, you know, nameplates and things like that. And it doesn't necessarily need to be brand led. It can be more nameplate led. So people think of like GTI, they might think of ST, they might think of RS, but, you know, BMW TI on a front wheel drive hatchback might not be the first thing that comes to mind. And the car that I had was actually optioned up quite a bit. So it had about $8,000 worth of options on it. So they start at 56,900 plus on roads, which on the road will probably set you back around or just a little bit over $60,000. But this one had the comfort package, which had electric front seats with lumbar support and steering wheel heating. There was a leather upgrade, a panoramic glass sunroof, and a Harman Kardon premium sound system. So each of those sort of cost between $1,000 and $2,000. So the asking price with these options is $63,473. And it didn't even have the driver assistance pack, which brings BMW's excellent adaptive cruise control and lane centering function, which is a bit silly on a car this price, I think, to not have that. But it does have the interior of a premium car, I feel. BMW's done a really good job with its interiors on everything bar the X1 and X2. The 1 Series has the latest sort of layout. It's got iDrive 7. It's got all the nice big screens, wireless CarPlay, all that kind of stuff. The materials are really, really nice, especially when we've seen things like the Volkswagen Golf sort of step away from interior quality. We've seen BMW really amp it up. So it's just a little bit, you know, give and take. And I think it's more down to personal preference. For me personally, I think for my taste in this kind of segment, I perhaps would look at other options, but I can see why this would appeal to a lot of people, because some people just really love the BMW brand. They might like the look of the new 1 Series, and the fact that they can get a one that's got, you know, high performance powertrain, that fun front wheel drive balance, and it's, you know, a sub $60,000 starting price is very, very appealing. And no doubt we'll see a lot of them on the road. I think it's actually cheaper than a Mini JCW hatch. So go figure. But yeah, it's just, I don't know. Objectively, it's a very good car. I just think for a vehicle that's competing in like an enthusiast segment, I think that it has a mild identity crisis, and some of the looks of it might polarize, and so will the options list. So yes, I don't really have a very definitive conclusion yet, but yeah, what can you do?
Moko, did you get a little bit of time behind this wheel? Do you know?
No, I didn't spend any time in this car, and I think I tend to agree with Wongy on the face of it. You know,
yeah.
I think this car does have a bit of an identity crisis. I think the new 1 Series drives beautifully in its other specs that I've driven, but you can never go past the previous generation with the 6-cylinder, the manual option, and the rear drive. I don't care if this new one's 100 times better technically. It doesn't move my soul like the old one did, and for me, the whole purpose of a hot hatch is to stir the soul. You know, everything else is secondary to that, so... Swing and a miss for mine, and I say that as a BMW owner and a BMW fan.
Well, keep your eye on the site for that review. We'll be coming up very soon. There goes another Car Expert podcast. All right, Joe, give us the lowdown on the garage for next week.
It's very full in Melbourne. So we've got a SsangYong Musso XLV ELX. Oh, God, that's so many letters. We've got an Audi Q2 40 TFSI Quattro. Again, our letters. We've got two Hondas. We've got a Honda CR-V VTI-X, and we've got a Honda Accord VTI-LX. So that'll be cool, because the Accord's one of those cars that you don't see a lot of anymore, but I still think that nameplate carries some weight. We've also got an exciting mid-size SUV Duo coming in later in the week. So we've actually got the updated Subaru Forester coming in, and we've also got the brand new Kia Sportage. So there's some cool content that we have planned there, but I can't talk too much about it, so stay tuned to the site. In Sydney, we have the Jaguar XE P300 all-wheel drive R-Dynamic Black Edition. We love a JLR, long name. And in Brisbane, we've also got the Ford Ranger FX4 Max, the Ram 1500 Limited, and the Ford Everest Trend.
Fantastic. Well, if you have any comments or questions for us, we're always welcoming your emails at podcast@carexpert.com.au. You, Mike Costello, and James Wong, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mandy.
Thanks as always, guys.